Please join us October 15th and 16th at the New York Hilton Midtown for Programmatic I.O., the world's largest conference focused on programmatic marketing. You'll be treated to 2 impactful days, 6 tailored agendas, and over 50 sessions on the latest programmatic trends, issues, and best practices. Hear from innovators, industry leaders, researchers, and analysts on both the buy side and the sell side of programmatic. Visit programmatic.io/New York for details. Join us and get educated.
Welcome to AdExchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
This episode is sponsored by Comcast Technology Solutions, which provides a suite of solutions for both the demand and supply sides of the advertising industry. Later in the episode, Richard Nunn, VP and GM of the Comcast Technology Solutions ad platform, chats with AdExchanger's Zach Rogers about the role of dynamic content optimization in the ad ecosystem.
Hey everybody, this is Zach Rogers. I'm the executive editor of AdExchanger. Good to be with you. And I'm pleased to welcome Kevin Krim to the studio. Kevin is the CEO of EDO, a company that brings a data science approach to measuring television advertising. The idea, as I understand it, is that traditional TV networks and studios are at a data and technology disadvantage. They need analysis tools to compete with big tech, Netflix, Google, et cetera. And they work with advertisers as well. In preparing for the podcast, I was really struck by EDO's investors, Jim Breyer of Breyer Capital, Robert Smith of Vista, Mike Walrath, the Goodhart brothers, and Edward Norton, the actor. We're going to talk about that and many other things here. Welcome, Kevin.
Thanks, Zach. Great to be here.
Yeah, good to have you. So give us a minute on you. Like, where are you coming from? I know, like, you, before we went on mic here, we were talking about your very early days in the late 90s.
Sure, yeah.
Sort of pre-bust startup environment.
Yeah, I spent the first half of my career as a Silicon Valley product manager focused on content and advertising products. And in particular, I focused a lot on search advertising and social advertising products. And then about 10 years ago, moved to New York and took on two roles, very similar roles at Bloomberg Digital and CNBC Digital, running their global operations. And you know, I was struck in those two worlds how big of a gap there is in between digital and the ability to have data at our fingertips for every decision, and then moving to be the digital person inside of two different TV networks. I was struck by my TV colleagues having very little data, if any, to make informed decisions about what was working best and how to do more of that and less of what wasn't. And so that's a lot of the inspiration for what EDO does.
Okay, right. Gotcha. So, yeah, I want to get into the EDO origin story. But first, let's fast forward for a minute to, so prior to EDO, you were at Bloomberg.
And CNBC.
Yeah, CNBC
most recently.
What were you doing in those roles?
Yeah, so CNBC, I was running basically everything that wasn't on TV. So the website, all the digital apps, the editorial and the technology. It was a really cool integrated focus. And you know, one of the things that struck me is right at the same time as we were building out the digital business, we were also building out our primetime originals lineup on TV. And we would put a lot of emphasis, as you can imagine, on trying to premiere these new shows with strong ratings. And we would do all sorts of work to promote across platform, try to drive people to watch TV. And we were consistently hampered by the lack of good data on what was working in terms of driving people to tune in to CNBC's new shows like The Prophet and so forth. And so that stuck in my head. And I had done a startup kind of at the beginning of my career and had been wanting to get back to the world of startups. And, and was also struck by how I'd hear these anecdotal kind of things from different direct-to-consumer brands who were advertising heavily on TV. This was in the, you know, kind of 2014-15 timeframe.
Yeah.
And you had people like Dollar Shave Club, very famously, but also you had all the endemic trading platforms who were advertising heavily on CNBC, like Schwab or TD Ameritrade or Fidelity. And we would do these big integrated campaigns for them on their behalf. And we would do these reviews with them and they'd say, you know, you don't have data on this, but we love those integrated moments on TV where you do some live sponsorship mentions.
Yeah.
And I said, right. Why do you like those so much? And they said, well, because we see these bursts of engagement mm-hmm. on our platforms as you put our brands on air. And that is really fundamentally kind of the seed of what we're doing at EDO is trying to say, here's how consumers are reacting in real time to.
Right. So it's like taking this idea, you know, from internet advertising that every advertising interaction is measurable and informs the next campaign and increases the overall intelligence of the marketer or the, you know, media platform where the ad is running.
Right.
And bringing that into the sort of brand-driven television environment where everything's just sort of taken on faith. The measurement is, you know, panel-based. And I mean, that's changing, of course, but that's it, is to just bring far more sort of data signals into the TV.
That's right.
Measurement. Okay, great. So how, well, before we get into the how, because I want to, I got to talk about the funding.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, let's talk about that.
I mean, you heard me say that at the top, all of these amazing, you know, investors, you know, it's really a who's who. And then beyond that with Edward Norton.
Right. Yeah.
How did that come about?
I mean, so.
And we're not talking about a huge amount of money either. You know, altogether, your first round was $12 million.
Right. Which, to me, still sounds like a lot of money, but it is in the scheme of things, modest amount of capital. We're very capital efficient. You know, the beginning of this really goes back to when I was at CNBC. I met a founder of a startup called Kensho Technologies. The founder's name Daniel Nadler. He had created an advanced data science company for financial analytics. Mm-hmm. Kensho, a year and a half ago, got acquired by S&P Global for, you know, a really great kind of exit for them. And we had partnered closely at CNBC. And Daniel was a close partner. And one of his key investors, early believers as an angel, was Edward Norton.
Okay.
And people don't realize about Edward that he's got a lot going on outside of his film career. Mm-hmm. He also has a lot going on in his film career, but he's a Yale graduate. His peer group is a mix of Hollywood folks and finance and private equity and venture capital.
Okay.
And so he's often involved in early stage funding, and he's even started his own company. His wife and he and some partners started CrowdRise, which merged with GoFundMe.
Right. I remember.
So he's got this whole life that I think a lot of people don't realize.
So he's a big angel.
Big angel investor. Okay. He was an early angel investor in Uber and you know, mm-hmm. so he's got a good track record.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to Daniel, I love what Kensho does for finance. Could we take this idea of advanced data science and bring it to a place that is very familiar for me, which is film and television? And mm-hmm. and that was the seed of EDO mm-hmm. getting started.
It was Daniel or Edward who had that
It was Edward's idea to say, what you've done for finance, could we do something separate?
Yeah, gotcha.
But parallel to what Kensho did for finance, could we do that for entertainment and media?
Okay,
and that was the start of what eventually became EDO.
Mm-hmm.
I got involved because I knew Daniel, and he knew that I wanted to get back to my startup roots, and it was sort of a nice serendipitous moment.
And the dominoes just fell with Robert Smith, and Goodhartz.
Yeah, and so Jim Breyer had also had an early role in funding Kensho, so he believed in Daniel, and Jim has this very interesting kind of straddling set of experiences between hard, you know, true tech at Accel, mm-hmm. but also he had been a board member of Marvel before they sold to Disney. Mm-hmm. He also still is a board member of the Fox Corporation, 21st Century Fox, the new Fox, I guess, is what they're calling it.
Yeah, right.
He's been in Hollywood. He was also an early funder of Legendary, the film company. So he's had a heavy role in Hollywood for a long time as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so he saw the potential of this from early days. He was our seed funder. He was also led our A round through Breyer Capital. And then, Edward Norton, just because he's got so many outside interests, he met Robert Smith through I don't even know where. And started talking to him about the idea. Robert, through Vista, he and his co-founder, Brian Sheth, basically, I mean, their whole thesis of investing is enterprise software and data companies have a uniquely powerful business model. They get embedded in the business workflow of companies, and they become, you know, multi-decade powerful franchises. As long as you've got one of the number one or number two player in one of those markets, it's an incredibly powerful business model. That's the entirety of Vista Equity's portfolio, is businesses like that. Yeah. So they don't do venture investing through Vista.
Right.
But on a personal level, they were excited to back EDO, and they've been great backers. And that Vista kind of network includes MediaOcean and Bill Wise, the CEO of MediaOcean.
And that's the link to WGI, which is the ad tech guys.
You know, Bill and Jonah and Mike Walrath and Noel Goodhart, they all are part of that DoubleClicks, Right Media.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm not sure I've ever seen quite an interesting list of investors.
So. Yeah, no, it's a great list.
So let's talk about the how, because as I understand it, you're using different sources of data.
Yeah.
Sort of a data integration approach where you've got metadata from, you know, that you're licensing, and then you've got some viewing data. Could you talk a little bit about how you do what you do?
Yeah. It's quite interesting. And quickly, just to kind of frame it.
Of course.
Our thinking is that on some fairly sort of deep level, the measurement tools available to marketers influence the goals they set and the way they think about the potential of what they're doing. And the limitations of the measurement tools traditionally have had this, in my view, insidious effect of limiting the goals that marketers set for themselves on their TV campaigns in particular. They think that because you have to either measure just audience exposure or attitudinal changes through some survey and panel-based methodologies, that they have to choose either a brand campaign with those as your sort of ways of measuring it.
Right.
Or I can do a performance campaign where I'm doing a sales event
call to action or
whatnot. And then I can maybe measure some behavioral effects downstream, down funnel. Our point of view is that it's not an or. It should be an and. And that's fundamentally based on the consumer behavior. The consumer is sitting there not kind of watching television and saying, oh, this ad that's coming up here, this is a brand ad, so therefore I'm going to sit on my hands and just, you know, ponder what's been, you know, what I've seen. Or this is a call to action ad. I'm therefore going to, you know, grab my phone or grab my laptop or go walk into a store and buy. The consumer is just sitting there and saying, what's on right now? And when they see a message that is compelling to them, they react. That fundamentally, we as consumers in the 21st century have this Pavlovian sort of behavior that's been sort of ingrained in us that we can take action right now. We've got connected devices at our fingertips at all times. We should, if we see something interesting to us, we should grab our phone and learn more. We should go start shopping. We should go look for, you know, locations and all those other actions that are the beginnings of the path to purchase. And fundamentally, whether it's a brand campaign or a performance-oriented campaign, those behaviors are the same.
Right.
And if you're a direct-to-consumer brand who owns your funnel completely and it's entirely a digital funnel, then you basically, if you've instrumented your website and your mobile apps correctly, you'll see the reaction instantaneously. But for everyone else, which is the vast majority of people advertising on television right now, they don't own their funnels. Their funnels are scattered around the internet and offline through a whole network of, you know, people who are helping them sell
it. The retail gatekeepers on their data.
Yeah. And that's true whether it's CPG or automotive or film, like movies, or you name it, insurance even, right? Where you still have these massive leaks of data that are hindering your ability as a marketer to see what's happening in your funnel as you run your campaigns on air, on TV. So we are trying to give visibility to all those people by watching the gateway behaviors that are leading people down funnel. The biggest one is search, by far and away.
Yep.
And so we're very heavy consumers of the open APIs around search. But we also see that people go in through YouTube, Wikipedia, Facebook. There's all these different pathways to interact with brands and
so
learn
there's
more.
There's owned and operated. Then there's the search.
Yeah.
And then there's other third-party platforms where
That's right.
you may have access to data. Cool. All right, great. So with the search data, sounds like that was the first one you mentioned, and that's
yeah,
probably...
it's the most important one.
It's the most important one. Now, as I understand it, Google is doing search attribution as part of Google 360.
That's right.
So where are you getting your search? Because I think that's an important sort of edge that Google has in the attribution space.
That's right.
You know, but they're a big media platform as well, so there's trust issues there. But talk a little bit about, okay, so your value proposition is search signals linked to TV ads. So therefore, Google is your main competitor. Agree or disagree?
Disagree.
Okay.
Only because Google fundamentally is not focused on the TV part of that. Of what you just described.
Uh-huh.
So a big part of the effort we go through is collecting all that consumer signals of intent indicating behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of collection that we have to do. Mm-hmm. But then we have to marry that to the TV ad occurrences.
Mm-hmm.
So a big part of what we do that's technologically hard mm-hmm. is monitoring all of national TV 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
Chopping up all of the TV programming into content and ad breaks,
mm-hmm.
and in those ad pods, understanding what ad is running when and where,
right,
down to the second with total precision.
So everything has to be time stamped to the second.
To the second,
and then matched to search queries.
Yeah, and you have to be 99.99959 accurate around which creative is running.
Do you partner on that view data?
No,
the TV airing data.
We found that. There was no providers out there that could get to the level of accuracy that we needed to be able to give the kind of actionable insights to our advertising clients. So we had to do it ourselves. So we developed, and it's taken years to do this, but we've developed our own ability to do computer vision and audio fingerprinting of all these TV streams. So 120 national networks. We are basically monitoring them in New Jersey and in San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
We're uploading them all to the cloud. So all of TV mm-hmm. all the time mm-hmm. is in the cloud, and we are monitoring in real time what's running, and we're okay. identifying ad breaks, the ads in them, and we're tagging all of that.
Yeah.
And right, that's a massive undertaking. We've processed, since the beginning of 2015, 60 million national TV ad airings.
Okay.
Each one then is scored on how it changes search behaviors and other
okay.
key kind of gateway behaviors that
yeah,
lead people
right,
down funnel.
Right, right, right. Okay.
But it's that marrying of those two data sets.
So yeah, you're saying it's not the same as Google's analytics around search linked to TV because they don't have that TV ad database.
Not
that I want to force us into like a narrow discussion around you competing with Google. I just think it's interesting.
Yeah. And I think by all accounts, what we're doing is reinforcing the core message that Google's out there propagating, which is that search is the best indicator of true
yeah.
consumer demand and intent.
Yeah, it's certainly a convenient data source.
So one of the effects that psychologists and behavioral economists have known about for a long time is that mm-hmm. when you try to ask people questions about their future behavior, there's even if you get all the kind of questioning right and all the sampling right, all that. The bias that is impossible to really get rid of is projection bias.
Mm.
That human beings, because of our egos and the way our egos get in the way of us answering questions honestly,
mm-hmm.
People are just really bad at predicting their future behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You ask somebody, do you want to go see that movie that's coming out in 3 months? Or are you interested in buying a new car in 6 months?
Mm-hmm.
You start to answer the question not based on your true intentions. Sometimes you don't even know them, but you're answering based on what you think the other person wants to hear. What you want to project to the world is your outward image.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically when you try to use that data to forecast outcomes,
mm-hmm.
the error rates are like plus minus 50% in a bunch of categories that we've studied closely.
Hmm.
But what the academics know and what we've seen very extensively in our own data is that if you want to know what people are going to do in the future, you watch what they do. Don't listen to what they say.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fundamentally like the contrast we're drawing here in the marketplace is if you want to understand the efficacy of your campaigns, look at the behavioral data sets that are honest. Mm-hmm. People don't waste their time searching for stuff that they're not interested in. Mm-hmm. Now, we do a lot of work to say, let's filter out any curiosity-based searches, right? We all have done the thing where, who's the actor who plays Jan in the Toyota sales event commercials?
Okay.
Right?
You know, like, interesting.
We don't want that. That's not indicative of intent.
Okay.
That is just curiosity.
Yeah.
Well, what's that song playing in that, you know, in that ad?
Got you.
Not what we're counting as signal.
All right.
But when people say Toyota dealership near me, or, you know, reviews of this new movie, those are strong signals of intent. Mm-hmm. And they correlate incredibly well as a leading indicator with eventual sales.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, great. We're going to take a moment's break here from a sponsor. I'll be right back with Kevin Krim of EDO.
Hi, and I'm back with Richard Nunn, VP and GM of the Comcast Technology Solutions ad platform. Richard, so DCO, dynamic creative optimization, is getting more attention these days. What's your take on it?
It very much is a hot topic. And the very simple reason why is there's an emergence of, I guess, reality. And that reality is the sophistication of media targeting is such that we can get down to that individual level. And certainly with the emergence of IP addressable TV down to that household. But guess what? The reality is everyone sees the same ad. And that's an issue. So advertisers are realizing that, the agencies are now realizing that. But again, the old school model of how to version, take a core asset and version that into 600 versions, 6,000 versions, 60,000 versions is pretty much an impossibility in the way that that was done and has been done for many, many years. So what's now emerging, and certainly we're on this, and there are other people doing it, is how you use technology to automate creative versioning on the fly using real-time data to provide a personalized ad. And that can be done and is being done today. Now, the next phase of that is how you then link that version into an ad management platform to then distribute that ad seamlessly. So this is not about DCO in isolation. This is around using DCO technology, unifying it into some sort of ad management platform or solution to then have a seamless buy-side automated platform taking creative ads, live data in real time, and getting personalized ads straight to that eyeball in a seamless way, with frankly, without a lot of manual intervention. So that's what we're working on. And it certainly, as you say, rightly a hot topic that has to be solved because of the sophistication of media targeting that we now have.
All right, and I'm back with Kevin. So we've been talking about sort of why search and behavioral signals are needed to make sort of television measurement better than it's ever been. And so one more on that was just sort of where you said you're big on the search APIs. Could you elaborate a little bit more on the sources of search, search data that you
know, I would say there's a variety of ones. Google's got the best.
Yeah.
Data, full stop. We've just learned a lot about how to use it in a very granular way. So one of the things that we spend a lot of time on is being very specific about signals of intent. So filtering out anything that we think is extraneous or noise. But then also, you want it to be very, very granular. So so we pull the data at a minute by minute level so that you can see these changes, because some of them are quite small and quite fleeting. That's like a fascinating dynamic at play here that I want you to be able to visualize, is that most of the spikes in engagement that we see are a few minutes and then they're gone and you're back to the baseline level.
Yeah.
Now, the two things you have to be good at are granularity of the data and handling those very large data sets that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But you also have to be good at detecting what the true baseline is and what departures from the baseline are. And that's where the data science becomes quite sophisticated. Mm-hmm. It's not a big deal to see a big spike in, you can go into Google Trends and pull out a spike from a Super Bowl ad. That's not hard.
Mm-hmm.
What's hard is to see the effect of an ad on a late night cable rerun of Bob's Burgers.
Yeah.
Like, right. And by the way, those will create spikes, but to see that mm-hmm. is mathematically at the scale we're talking about quite mm-hmm. quite sophisticated mm-hmm. in terms of the data science that we utilize.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's a big deal.
Got you. Okay. And then talk a little bit, we've got this big shift towards television on demand. Obviously linear is still huge. Are you doing anything to go after that more sort of that SVOD world? Or is that just sort of not in your sweet spot and you're really all about linear?
That's where our future product roadmap is focused, is okay. on that non-linear television world.
Okay.
It's clearly very valuable. It's in huge demand. Mm-hmm. Every conversation I have with an advertiser mm-hmm. Or with the TV networks that we also serve who are selling the advertising, mm-hmm. both sides of this ecosystem
yep.
care a ton about it. The okay. consumer behavior is hugely important in its shift towards, I want to watch live TV live and everything else I'd like to watch when I want to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, sports, news, and special event programming, including those competition shows that are an increasingly important part of the, mm-hmm. the programming lineups for all the TV networks because yeah. they know this effect is at play.
Yeah.
I want to watch the live stuff live,
mm-hmm.
right? I want to be able to engage with my friends on it. I want to be social about it. I want to be, I want to be real time.
Mm-hmm.
But anything that we would call basically entertainment mm-hmm. outside of those categories, that's going to be consumed on an on-demand basis,
mm-hmm. okay.
which is not live,
right.
which means the very unique and powerful effects of linear TV, as we've come to think of it, the powerful effect of being able to have sight, sound, and motion messaging as a marketer and have that delivered many impressions all at once,
mm-hmm.
that's really powerful, but it's increasingly scarce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
now,
right.
That's why,
sure.
That's why the upfronts are still seeing pricing increases right. when ratings are down, because the scarcity is there for something that people want.
Right.
It's important just to remind ourselves in this industry that there are a lot of cases where marketers want to reach a lot of people all at once.
Mm-hmm.
So the power of live television is still very, mm-hmm. very right. real right. for a lot of right. marketers.
Sure.
Whether you got to open a blockbuster movie mm-hmm. on a certain weekend, you got to convince millions and millions of people to all see the same movie at the same time,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
or you got to sell 100,000 trucks next month.
Right.
Like you need to be able to reach a lot of people all at once.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all of that. But yes, non-live, non-linear is huge. Now, a lot of it today is not ad-supported. Mm-hmm. We don't talk much about that
right.
reality.
I will.
So the inventory levels that are available are not anywhere near where you are with live TV.
It's definitely an existential situation for yeah. television advertising.
Right.
The migration to SVOD. Although, as you say, there's still a huge audience for live, and that's going to continue for years and years to come. But it's just the available television advertising, especially reaching certain audiences, is shrinking.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a secular decline that continues for a long time.
Absolutely.
So the
shift in hours, which is the only thing that's finite in this world, right, is the
yeah.
number of hours available uh-huh. to all of us as consumers. That finite thing, the shift has definitely been to nonlinear but subscription and not ad supported.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a really good thing for people like Hulu who have TV
yeah.
quality
yeah.
content with advertising as the main
mm-hmm.
monetization model. Like, it's great for them because there's tons of demand
mm-hmm.
to have the targetability and trackability of
yeah.
digitally delivered ads, but they want that TV quality content mm-hmm. alignment.
Yeah, I'm curious, like, what's your prognosis? For you, a lot of the big traditional media companies are your clients.
Yeah.
So you're not going to tell me right now that they're in bad trouble. But
no.
I mean, if you look around, I mean, just very recently we had Apple announce basically a free streaming television service. We have Disney announcing a very cheap one.
Yeah.
Netflix is still cheap. HBO is going to have to stay cheap in these mostly non-ad supported environments.
And yeah.
there's billions and billions of funding for television shows that are essentially going to be running ad free. It's going to be tricky for traditional media to monetize. Companies that are publicly traded that need to continue to show profit, they can't go into like deep losses.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what you think as sort of an observer of the internet and media ecosystem.
Yeah, I'm confident. I'm confident that a blend of models will continue to thrive. Mm-hmm. Cable TV is a combination of subscription and advertising supported. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for all of the issues that we all have with sort of cable television in sort of, you know, it writ large when we're thinking of our consumer experiences, at the end of the day, we love its convenience. We love its selection. We love its reliability. There's all these things we do really like about it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that model will likely thrive in the future. I'm bullish on Hulu's future. I'm bullish on NBC Universal's to-come streaming ad-supported service. And it, you know, very logical response by them to say, we're not entering this market early. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people with strong subscription offerings at this point. We've got a great library.
Yeah.
Let's do ad-supported because there's tons of demand for that. Mm-hmm. Now, what the market lacks is good, true syndicated objective measurement. That's where I hear all the time that it is a hindrance to the success and growth of the ad-supported part of the SVOD, on-demand, OTT.
Yeah, we've got a lot of the networks trying to come up with, you know, in the absence of a strong independent measurement kind of platform.
Like they're making it up
as they go. Yeah. And it's, you know.
C-Flight, which is a good idea.
NBC's, yeah.
Is a response to the inadequacies of the offerings from the Nielsen's and Comscore's of the world.
Right. So here you come galloping into town. How are you guys going to make money off of this challenge? Or how's it going so far?
It's going quite well. So what's different?
You're making money from the platform or from the services around it or a combination?
We license on a subscription as a service kind of model. So it's a flat fee for an annual license. It's not generally, it's quite expensive if you were to try to come off the street and do it. But like, you know, these companies, relative to what they've been spending on market research and measurement, we drive a ton of economies of scale because the vast majority of what we do is an automated software platform that is always on and fully available with a huge historical data set. So the incremental cost to us to serve new clients is not that great. So we are passing on a lot of savings relative to other ways that people have gotten data that's not nearly as rich as this, but is in that same sort of category as advertising efficacy and media measurement. So so we charge on that model, both the ad sellers, so the TV networks, the ad buyers. We work often through agencies, and we're more than happy to do that. But we price every engagement that we have, every subscription, on a per brand basis, and we're looking at the volume that they do on national TV, and that's how we set the fees. The fascinating thing is that the ad sellers are also really starting to finally try to build out the advertising platforms that will enable a more programmatic, sophisticated way of planning and executing and then optimizing their TV campaigns. Mm-hmm. And those platforms, whether it's the Ignite platform from Warner Media or the Vantage platform from Viacom, they all have a named platform that is a big investment for them. They need this kind of data set to power the ability for them to build automated, optimized campaigns and then to keep optimizing those campaigns as they run based on a data set that is aligned with the objectives of their clients. Mm-hmm. The beauty of what Facebook and Google have done is built self-optimizing platforms that use the measurement of success as the optimizer. Mm-hmm. So it is, and this is a completely, you know, transparent and legitimate way of doing it, but they are grading their own homework on a metric that they can use as their optimizer. Mm-hmm. They are guaranteed to succeed.
Oh, yeah.
In that kind of model, right?
Right.
Yeah. You know, if CTR or ROI or whatever measure is set as the goal with the parameters of budget and time frame, and you're an advertiser and they hit those numbers, you're happy. And they're basically, like, their data science says
you're
that
happy, they're rich.
Yeah. TV has not had that model.
Yeah.
Right? Like, Nielsen ratings are not directly in the control of the broadcaster,
the networks.
And you certainly can't optimize a campaign on the ex post facto like rating number, which can vary quite a bit. Yep. Like you need something that's real time and that is got the statistical rigor to be able to say like within a tight confidence interval, I know what this number is going to be in the future. And it's the number that is the true goal of the client. Mm-hmm. So that is like, that's where I'm really excited about the future of TV's advertising and how we think we're helping enable that.
So how do you rate
future.
The progress towards that? And what's your roadmap for the next two years or 3 years?
I'd say we're only in like the first third of that rollout of those platforms. We're in the important part where everyone has one now or is in the midst of rolling one out. Mm-hmm. The consolidation of media companies is going to enhance the investment in those mm-hmm. platforms, right? Mm-hmm. A combined Disney plus the Fox TV assets, the cable assets, that'll make their investment in it more powerful. Mm-hmm. They'll get more leverage out of it. Comcast, NBC Universal is getting, I think, really interesting leverage out of their investment. Viacom, CBS, mm-hmm. combined entity. Those are all good signals for the technological investment in it.
Right.
You need data providers like what we're doing to empower the literal transactions that are going on in them. Mm-hmm. And then you need the change in selling behavior and culture that will finally kind of take that potential and realize it. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. that's also like a really cool thing that we've started seeing signs of where some of our closer relationships with the networks are resulting in them building performance-oriented products where our metrics are the basis for how they build campaigns, optimize them, and how they guarantee outcomes mm-hmm. for marketers. And they're making it so that, if you care about kind of entries into your funnel, which most people do, like they're saying if we can lift it versus a baseline of X percent, then we want to get some share of extra, mm-hmm. Payment in compensation. And if you're getting a guarantee where you don't have to pay that if you don't hit the number, I mean, like mm-hmm. that's a kind of a no-brainer to say yes to if you're an agency or a brand.
How close is your product to it's like its end state?
I mean, nowhere close is our view.
Okay.
Right.
So
what do you
need to do?
So I mean we are fascinated, obviously, as I've said a lot, about nonlinear. We're also fascinated about richer metadata around how you can mm-hmm. cut and analyze this huge data set. I mean, 60 million ads are, and it's growing by hundreds of thousands every month. Mm-hmm. But how deeply you can analyze that is just a function of how much metadata is attached to it. So mm-hmm. we've invested in a brand new hierarchy of, or taxonomy of all the hierarchical relationships between companies, brands, products, and all the attributes of mm-hmm. that can be attached to an ad, so you can start to do even more powerful analytics around what are the true drivers of performance, mm-hmm. right? Because one thing I just want to...
So for example, like maybe a metadata set doesn't have product information that might be in a shot.
Right. I mean,
so then if you could add that to the metadata, for these 2 seconds, there's a Pepsi can in this frame of the screen.
Yeah.
Then that could be associated with search.
I mean, exactly. Like So, I mean, some of the examples that are real and now are the networks are doing really interesting experiments with ad format and ad duration. Mm-hmm. These prime pods or short pods, as they're called, where you get a dedicated 60-second spot or two advertisers only in a 30 mm-hmm. each. Like, that kind of experimentation, how do you measure its true change and impact? Mm-hmm. Our methodology is perfect for that. And, we're able to articulate why that is worth a premium mm-hmm. for the advertisers who are buying it. But then you can also do stuff like, when I'm an automaker and I put an incentive on in the ad, does that actually change the engagement levels or not?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Maybe I should just list the MSRP and then drive people into the funnel to figure mm-hmm. out whether there's a deal or not. Like, is putting, sort of dollar discounts on the ad actually a driver or not? Mm-hmm. Those kinds of deep experiments can only be done when we've got good metadata. Hmm. So that's a huge investment area. And then, local and international is always an interesting dilemma/opportunity when you're a company at our size. And
we've got tons
of choices and tons of
opportunities. You have to figure out which bets to make because that could be a huge distraction.
But we're serving big global companies who tend to want us to be able to serve them.
Yeah.
In all markets at once.
And yeah, so that makes sense.
We feel that pull. Mm,
interesting. Well, I want to make sure we leave time for one other topic, which is, so you experienced several years ago just a terrible personal tragedy. with the loss of two of your kids. Afterward, you and your wife created this nonprofit organization, the Lulu and Leo Fund, to bring arts and science programs to underprivileged kids and their families.
Yeah.
Could you talk just a little bit about what is Lulu and Leo Fund and sort of how it's going?
Yeah.
And if people want to learn more, what they can do.
Yeah. Thanks for asking, Zach, and appreciate it. So the Lulu and Leo Fund, obviously it's got a hugely important place in my wife and our lives. And there's a whole community of people who are involved in it. And we've now reached, going on 450 teachers and after school program coordinators who serve over 10,000 kids. So it's having a real impact in the world. The flagship initiative of it is called Choose Creativity. And fundamentally, creativity has been the thread through which we survived and have rebuilt our lives after losing Lulu and Leo. And they led these brief but very creative lives themselves. And so they're the inspiration of how creativity, it helps you build resilience. Mm-hmm. It also helps you see the opportunity, see the possibilities in the world, which is our sort of like tagline, if you will, for Choose Creativity, is see the possibility in every moment. Uh-huh. And so, you know, as an entrepreneur, creativity is hugely important to me. Obviously, we are serving creative industries through advertising, television, film. So there is that connection to what we're here talking about today. The thing is that the education system doesn't encourage creativity as one of its core values. So we've built this like whole program around what we experienced. So it comes very much from our heart, but we also, my wife's an educator and Marina, she's basically does what she does, which is to create and to build this curriculum around creativity as a core set of values that are a mindset, a way of living, a way of approaching school, a way of approaching daily life, a way of approaching kind of both opportunity and tragedy and anything in between. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're doing. We reach our partners through, we train the trainers. So we've got a great group of creative coaches who teach our curriculum and basically help instructors in after-school programs or teachers in school or other like homeless shelters, all sorts of places where you've got populations facing adversity, facing need, and how this can build a real strong foundational set of skills around how to cope with everything they're going through.
Right, great. Right on. Well, thank you so much for sharing all that. And so is the URL I've got is lululeofund.org.
That's right.
Is that right? So
that's right.
People listening, if you want to check it out.
Thanks so much.
And thank you, Kevin. Really enjoyed the conversation and good luck with it.
Thank you, Zach. Thanks.
And thank you, listener, for tuning in to yet another episode of the program. We'll see you next week.
This episode was brought to you by Comcast Technology Solutions. For more information on the suite of services for advertisers, visit www.comcasttechnologysolutions.com/advertising. Produced by Bigfoot Music and Sound in New York City.